This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. And this is Cousin Stiz, a 26-year-old from Dorchester, Massachusetts. He's an award-winning rapper and something of a hometown hero in Boston. But long before he would sell out venues or be affiliated with an NBA team, Stiz was just a kid from the neighborhood. Only a Game's Nico Emack has the story.
Stiz met many of the friends he has today playing football and basketball. These friends quickly became family. And together, they learned how to navigate the neighborhood.
Sports has always been it, like, especially being in Boston, like, all the championships and stuff like that, you know what I'm saying? It kind of goes hand in hand.
Stiz remembers the championships, the parades, and even some heartbreak.
What was it, the 03 playoffs when we lost? The Celtics lost? I shed a tear that year when we lost in the playoffs. And that's when I knew, like, dang, I'm a Boston sports fan. Like, my mom couldn't believe how heartbroken I was about it. Like, it was funny at first, and then she seen how really sad I was, and then it got real sad in the house.
The first time he ever went to a game at the TD Garden, Stiz sat in the nosebleeds with the local Boys and Girls Club. The Celtics lost that night, but he was just excited to be a part of the atmosphere.
I just remember those, the chants. Like, I don't remember the music that they play.
Years later, his love of sports and music would collide in a way many only dream about. Stiz got a call from the Celtics, offering him a job for the 2018-2019 season. Cousin Stiz was born Steven Goss. His friends gave him his nickname.
So he was just like, bro, we can't be calling you Steven. Like, and that's pretty much just where it came from. Like, boom, Stizzy.
He says he owes everything to Dorchester.
Everything, man. The way I walk, the way I talk, the way I act, the way I think, the way I react, you know, it's all my neighborhood.
Of Boston's 23 neighborhoods, Dorchester is the largest and most diverse.
You know, so I got a whole bunch of everything, but I ain't grew up in the best neighborhood, you know. Just because it was diverse doesn't mean, you know, that it was always good.
Crime, poverty, drugs, and death were the norm where Stiz grew up. But he knew there was more to life than that.
Something I always knew is, like, this wasn't it. Like, the hood wasn't it for me, you know what I'm saying?
Stiz says he had a great support system of friends and family. But the older he got, the harder it became to avoid the negative influences in his life.
That was, like, around the time, like, I started losing friends and stuff like that, you know what I'm saying? I was kind of acting out.
And that's when his mom gave him a choice.
Either go into the military or, like, goddamn, we gonna ship you out here.
Out here meant going to high school in the suburbs, an hour outside of Boston, away from his friends, away from trouble. And that's what he did.
I went to Reading Memorial High School in Reading, Mass.
Stiz enrolled in the METCO program. The METCO program started in 1966 after parents of black students boycotted segregation in the Boston public school system. Today, nearly 38 suburban school districts offer enrollment to inner-city kids who are looking for alternatives to their local schools.
It was a culture shock, man. Like, before that, I only knew what I knew. I only knew about going to school with kids that look like me, act like me, you know? And going out there was completely different. It gave me a head start to life, almost, in a way.
To get to school on time, Stiz would have to wake up at 5:40 in the morning. His father, who worked construction, would often be his alarm clock. From there, Stiz would hop on a special bus. It took 90 minutes to get from the city to the suburbs. Every now and then, he would catch a nap. Sometimes he would listen to music. Most times, he would just think.
And then I go to school, and, like, I see, like, how things are so much different, how people are living so much differently, you know, what money could really do, you know, and then I go back to the hood at 3 o'clock.
The first couple of times Stiz missed the METCO bus, his mom let him off easy. But after his sophomore year, she tightened the reins. That meant if Stiz missed the bus, he'd have to take public transportation to get to school. A ride that would have taken 90 minutes would stretch on for hours.
Catch the bus, ride it all the way to the train station. If you get on the red line, you got to take the red line to downtown crossing, you got to take the daggone orange line at North Station. You get off, then I got to catch that purple line train all the way to Reading.
The commute was a nightmare.
You got some time on your hands, dog. You got some time to, like, really do something, you know what I'm saying? So, like, one day I just, you know, decided to write something over what was it? It was a Lil Wayne beat. I think it was Throwing the Bag. Yep, on the No Ceilings mixtape. No Ceilings, baby. And that was the first one. Like, that was the first one.
For years, Stiz didn't tell his friends he was writing, let alone rapping. And when he finally did tell them, he didn't get the reaction he expected.
My homies told me I was trash until I got good. But that's what good real friends are for. My real friends was like, bro, no. But I ended up getting good. And then they was like, actually, you got something. You might actually got something going for you. So you should probably keep going, bro. And then it completely switched. And it was like, bet, we rocking 100% with it.
In June of 2015, Stiz released Suffolk County, his debut mixtape.
Who you know from out here? Your name ain't ringing no bells, boy. Who you know from out here?
It dealt with a wide variety of themes, but in particular, loss. You know, what's your relationship like with death?
Pretty familiar. I'm too familiar for my liking. It happens, you know, more frequently than I would like it to. Around me. Hope they don't forget me when I'm gone. When
I do, I hope hella heaven got some henny. Stiz was in his early 20s when his friend Damone Clark was diagnosed with a rare form of bone cancer.
F cancer. Forever, you know what I'm saying? But dog, like, he was a G, man. He took it better than we did. Like, he knew what it was, and he was just a gangster about it, man. He told us, like, man, we better not cry about it, and we gotta make sure everything, you know, we moving how we supposed to when he's gone. And I just, you know, I tried to.
Damone passed away in January of 2016, just days after his 17th birthday.
He was just a bright light. Like, he was a funny kid. Like, he was just a light, man. Like, for real, for real. I wish everybody could have met him. He was just a good kid with a good heart, for real.
Stiz named his second mixtape Monda after Damone and rededicated himself to his music. In July of 2017, Stiz released his first studio album. He became more than just a Boston rapper. His music began popping up on soundtracks and in TV shows. Then, in the fall of 2018, he got a call from the Boston Celtics, asking him to be the official voice of the 2018-2019 season. In his new role, he provides voiceover for hype videos pushed out on social media.
From game one to game 82 and beyond. Rest well, because tomorrow, we rise.
Stiz doesn't remember what music was playing at his first Celtics game, but he does remember the first time he heard his own music at the TD Garden. He had just finished playing a set at the Boston Calling Music Festival.
When I got there, I was already on 10 rowdiness, and then, like, when I heard my joint, it was big lit.
Dirty bands came from dirty work. Dirty bands that make their feelings hurt.
I try not to think about things too much, but that was huge. Like, you know, it felt like I almost was in the league, but I wasn't in the league, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's really what it felt like. Like, dang, I made it, like, to the league.
Then something really crazy happened. In week 6 of the NFL season, the New England Patriots beat the Kansas City Chiefs 43-40. And Tom Brady posted a victory video on Instagram with Stiz's music playing in the background.
5-2, that's the goal. Chicago next. Gonna need everybody. Gronk, you can line up however you want, and you keep stiff-arming people like that. Let's go! My kids are sleeping. Yeah,
I put the drink in the headlock. I can't even begin to describe my love for Tom Brady. So to see somebody like that, you know what I'm saying, for them to put me up on their page and, you know, give me that look, it's just like, man, I don't know. To see stuff like that just lets me know I'm in the right direction.
Cousin Stiz lives in L.A. now, almost 3,000 miles away from Dorchester. He knows he's lucky to have made it this far, but he hasn't forgotten about the people back home.
I want people to keep going, because there's a way, dog. Like, if I could do it, anybody could do it.
That story came from Only a Game's Nico Emack. It's time for three stories you should know. Last week, Colin Kaepernick reached a settlement with the NFL in his collusion case, and that's where we'll start this week. I'm joined by the Boston Globe's Nora Princiati and by Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of Arizona State University's Global Sport Institute. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks, Karen.
Thanks, Karen.
Nora, you're up first.
So yeah, I wanted to talk about Colin Kaepernick, which has obviously been the topic of much discussion since he settled his lawsuit against the NFL and its owners for allegedly colluding to keep him out of the league. I would argue that if you had to pick a side, I would say that Kaepernick won because, one, it's just so incredibly hard for a player to win in the legal system. But I think that there's a sort of muddling of his collusion case and the social justice causes, mostly related to police brutality against minorities, that led him to protest by kneeling during the national anthem in the first place. So one thing that I'm sort of foreseeing is that when he continues to support those causes, I'm foreseeing a lot of noise about, well, you got all this money, aren't you done? Shouldn't you just be quiet now? When I think that the answer is, of course, no. I mean, Colin Kaepernick's done something that is incredibly hard to do, which is to start a national conversation. So I don't see him just going away.
I think he wins if he does speak out going forward. I think the most difficult part of what Kaepernick's been doing over the past many months is not speaking, is not delivering his message directly on a regular basis. So if he does the book, if he does address issues of social justice in a way that he hasn't during this period of time, then he's a real winner. I think, you know, monetarily, you just don't know. I'm a lawyer in real life, and these settlements, especially when they're not disclosed. I mean, what it really means is both sides got a lot of information about each other, and there's still mysterious information that neither side knows. So never mind, we'd rather settle at this number and walk away. For the NFL, the big plus for them, it's tardy, but it is the idea that they have closed a chapter, that they can move on. And Commissioner Roger Goodell has not been fantastic at this. I mean, think back to the Ray Rice moment where it was closed and then he let it open back up again.
Right.
The NFL does now get to just completely ignore this situation. But I think that Colin Kaepernick still doesn't have a job. And I don't believe the people who say now he has a better chance of getting a job. And he can't talk about what he won from the NFL. It might mean that he can be less quiet about his protest and why he did it. But still, the NFL is just going to get to say that this chapter is over. Where I think, Nora, you make a good point that the activism certainly isn't over.
Right. I mean, I would guess that he is a professional activist mm-hmm. now.
I'll say this. The saddest thing is to not play. This man, yeah. as any athlete, has trained all this time to not have the opportunity to play. I don't know what number you can pay to make up for that. And, you know, as you age as an athlete, the opportunity to regain that time is gone. It's kind of, you know, Ali-esque in a sense that those years are gone. It would be wonderful in many ways if he did find the opportunity to play again, but I too am doubtful that there'll be at least an immediate opening for that.
Ken, it's your turn.
So mine is Zion Williamson. We saw him get injured in the game Duke versus North Carolina. A couple things happened. I mean, first, we were allowed once again to beat the dead horse of amateurism. We were allowed once again to say, you know, the only reason that he's in this position is because of the rules that are in place, because of the collective bargaining agreement with the NBA and the Players Association. Well, what do people think should be done in this moment? If the injury allows him to, should Williamson play any more this season? Or should he just make sure no further injury occurs and that he has his professional opportunity?
I think practically speaking, no, he shouldn't play.
You're not a Duke fan, clearly. Look at you.
I'm not a Duke hater, though. I would say if he really wants to, like if it means a lot to him, then go for it. I mean, we just sort of went through this a little bit with Kyler Murray deciding between the NFL and MLB. And kind of, you know, you run all the analyses and do the math and figure out the dollar amounts. And then you also just kind of have to say, well, what does he want?
Right.
Like, what does he want to do? So the fact that these guys can't profit off endorsements and off their likeness being
yeah.
used, that to me is my biggest issue with it. And semi-conversely, if he feels like having the stage of, you know, the remainder of the college basketball season, the NCAA tournament would be valuable to him or that it could harm his personal brand to stay out of it, I would understand that as a reason for playing. And like I said, I would understand just really wanting to do it being another reason for playing. But no, I think if I were advising him, I would say, just wait.
It's also interesting, people are bringing up the fact that in the lead up to this very game, someone asked Zion what he feels about the sort of one and done system. And this is his quote. "I always knew I would go to college. Even if they would have had the NBA road, I still would have come to college. You're never going to get this experience again." And I think that's great, right? Like, he wanted to go to college, but I think we can't forget that he actually didn't really have a choice. And the NBA is now looking at giving players a choice. And I think that that's really important, because I think we'd be having an entirely different conversation if we knew for sure that he was at Duke instead of the NBA because he was allowed to make that decision.
We've heard LeBron a few times saying, you know, he kind of wished he had a college moment. But it is something to think about. And if part of your goal is to get paid, maybe you should take advantage of that sooner rather than later.
I've had enough of these actually important topics. Let's get to something fun.
Yay.
What could be better than watching your NHL team win a home game? I've got it. Watching all the players come out on the ice, stand in a W formation, and fall down like dominoes. Or play duck, duck, goose, or...
Oh my God, it's a limbo. I feel like I'm in Honolulu.
This is what's been happening with when the Carolina Hurricanes win home games, and it has been glorious. So what's the problem here? Well, here's NHL commentator Don Cherry.
These guys, to me, are jerks. You have to do this in the National. They're still not drawn. This is to me, and I'll tell you one thing, they better not do this in the playoffs.
He's so upset he can't even finish a sentence.
I think that's kind of par for the course. But.
And by the way, Don Cherry was wearing a bright blue suit jacket with neon yellow dragons all over it while he was trying to be the arbiter of taste in the NHL. I mean, the Hurricanes responded to Don Cherry by selling Bunch of Jerks t-shirts. And I have to say, I love all of this.
Yeah, it's really fun because it just has this sort of goofiness.
Right.
It's like you're all on skates. And, I mean, for a team in the South, that relevancy is kind of a big deal when you're playing in that environment and trying to keep up a fan base. It's like the best thing that could happen to them, right? Like
right.
You're known for being the cool team that does these fun things, and you kind of have a heel with this like dude up in Canada wearing God knows what. I love it. I'm really into it.
Ken, where do you fall on this?
Yeah, don't let the NHL become the version that the NFL was, the no fun league kind of moment where you're pushing back against this kind of thing. Although, by the way, I think the NFL players have gotten too orchestrated, and these Hurricane guys have kind of picked up at the orchestration level. We've got the whole icecapades kind of orchestration going on. Although I will say, I have been paying attention to this. I mean, it's drawn in,
right.
You know, this L.A. kid to say, what's going on here? So I think it's a good thing for the sport.
One of Don Cherry's things was they're making fun of their opponents. And I'm like, no, their opponents are in the locker room. Like, this is not one of those in-your-face things.
Also,
this
their
is...
opponents lost. Sorry. Bye.
Nora is so much more cutthroat than me.
Well, also, this is a sport that for decades glorified dudes hitting each other in the face.
Yeah.
And now we're getting all up in arms about a limbo contest? Seems a little backwards to me.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been the Boston Globe's Nora Princiati. Thank you, Nora.
Absolutely. Go Hurricanes.
And Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of Arizona State University's Global Sport Institute. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you.
You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
This podcast is made possible by Samuel Adams. For 34 years, Samuel Adams has made their Boston Lager inefficiently. Sam Adams brews with 100% heirloom Mittelfrüh hops, lagering their beer for over a month. The Boston Beer Company, Boston, Mass. Savor the flavor responsibly.
The world is complicated, and for many of us, history class was a long time ago.
That's where we come in. I'm Rund Abdelfattah.
I'm Ramtin Arablouei, and we're the hosts of Throughline, NPR's new history podcast.
Every week, we'll dig into forgotten stories from the moments that shaped our world.
Throughline, history like you've never heard it before.
I'm Karen Given. Three of the most important men in Cassandra Edwards' life are named Nate.
I have Big Nate, who is my husband, Little Nate, and then Baby Nate.
Cassandra's grandson, Baby Nate, is 4 years old now.
Looks just like his father at that age. Acts just like his father at that age. And I did say to him, I said, you remind me so much of your daddy. He said, but Nana, my daddy's dead. I said, but your daddy's in you, you know? And he just hugged me. He said, it's okay, Nana. It's okay.
Cassandra and her husband raised their son in Spring Valley, a majority-minority suburb of New York City. Little Nate grew to be 6'8", and in 2016, he got a scholarship to play basketball at a junior college in San Diego. And as a mom, were you like, oh, that's really far away from where I am?
No, because I just wanted him, to be honest with you, I wanted him to be out of our environment here and be exposed to something different. So for me, it was a safe haven for him to get away.
But that safe haven couldn't protect Nate Edwards from what was to come. Just 6 weeks before the end of the school year, Cassandra would learn that her son had died, leaving behind his girlfriend, Amber Kodecker, and two sons, Baby Nate, who was two at the time, and Dallas, just 8 months old. When Cassandra Edwards met with the president of San Diego City College, she had one request.
I want to be able to tell my son's story. I don't want anyone else to do that. I want to tell his story because I think he's going to help save many lives.
But in the late summer of 2018, a student video project started getting a lot of buzz.
Aspiring journalist and current SDSU student David Pradell spent much of his time at San Diego City College.
Cassandra wasn't happy.
No, I wasn't happy at all. I didn't know who he was, and I didn't know what his agenda was.
The documentary project was linked to a GoFundMe account that claimed to be raising money to send Nate's children to college. But nobody had told Cassandra about this. Nobody had set up a trust in her grandson's names. How could she be sure the money would end up where it belonged? Cassandra needed answers, so she called up the student filmmaker. His name is David Pradell.
And we, you know, talked on the phone, and I told her, you know, everything.
And it turns out this kid is just as innocent as he wants to be.
The story Cassandra heard that day not only changed the way she saw David and his video project, it also changed the way she remembers her son. But before we go any further, I need to warn you, we're going to explore the subject of suicide. This story might not be for everyone. The story begins in the summer of 2016. David Pradell was headed into his final year studying broadcast journalism at San Diego City College.
I started to get overwhelmed mentally and physically, I wasn't in the right mindset.
David had experienced anxiety and depression since high school. But that summer, his symptoms intensified. He started questioning everything he'd been doing for the past 3 years. Had he picked the right major? Was he talented enough to make a career out of it? Or had he just wasted his time? Irrational thoughts took over every aspect of David's life.
To the point where I couldn't really eat. You know, I lost 30 pounds coming into my final year at City College.
David's not a big guy, so when he suddenly lost 30 pounds, people noticed.
I told my professor that I just had a stomach flu and I was a little sick over the summer, and you know, I kind of brushed it off that it wasn't really anything serious.
But was it serious? I mean, were you thinking of harming yourself?
Yeah, I got to a point where, you know, I didn't have these thoughts of suicide, and I didn't think there was another option.
David spent the first few weeks of the semester just going through the motions, attending classes, working on assignments, but he says his heart wasn't in it. Then along came October and the beginning of the basketball preseason. Basketball is David's favorite sport, so he figured maybe he could find motivation to produce a season preview for his school newscast.
So I did it, even though, you know, deep down I was struggling a bit. Their energy on the court when I was there, you know, was a little bit inspiring in a way. to actually push myself and, you know, make a good video for the Friday newscast.
We all have the right work ethic. You see guys behind me in here getting shots up. Guys are afterwards getting shots up.
David posted some photos of that practice on social media. About a week later, he got a message from Nate Edwards. It was just a couple of lines on Twitter, thanking David for sharing the photos, telling him that he'd done a good job. Nate probably didn't think twice about sending it, but David says in that moment, it was exactly what he needed to hear.
It felt good to get that support from a player who, you know, is like my age and, you know, not a professor or a coach.
David kept covering the basketball team. He even interviewed Nate.
And what's the number one strength you think the team has right now that's going into the next round?
Our defense and our depth. You know, we're super deep. We got good chemistry, and we love playing with each other. Everybody loves each other, and we play great deep.
Week by week, the team improved, and so did David.
You know, just the energy and the love that they had for each other during this time was infectious and motivating, and I used that to apply that to my classroom work and making the effort to be healthy.
David Priddell might not have felt this way, like he could draw energy from the team's success, if not for Nate Edwards, who always made David feel like he was part of the team. David says Nate's biggest basketball contributions came from the bench, where he was constantly supporting and encouraging his teammates. And David felt that support and encouragement beyond the gym.
You know, every time I would post a photo on Instagram or post something on Twitter, he would be like the first like.
Do you think he knew you were going through a hard time?
No, I don't think so.
So he's just this nice to everyone?
Yeah, I think you know, if you're on his team, you know, you're on his side, he's going to take care of you.
Nate's teammates noticed his kindness, too.
One time I remember I was walking up to go to school.
This is from an interview David recorded with Jameer Mitchell, who was a sophomore on the team.
I had ran into Nate and I was like, he's like, where are you going? I was like, I'm about to get something to eat at McDonald's. And I was like, I only got $2. He was like, man, you want something to eat? I'm like, yeah, I said I'm about to go to McDonald's. I only got $2. He's like, do you want something to eat? So we walked down to the taco shop. He's like, get what you want, man. He got me whatever I wanted. Whatever you need, he'll go through hell and back, really. You know what I'm saying? Just make sure you're all right.
David says Nate was the biggest reason why the team came together. They played with love, and they believed that was what carried them through an undefeated conference schedule and into the playoffs.
And, you know, San Diego City College won the state title, the first title in 66 years, so...
So as a journalist, you must have thought, oh, I have my Cinderella ending. This is just perfect, right?
Yeah. It was the perfect ending.
When the team returned to San Diego, local news stations thought so too.
My name is Nate Edwards from Spring Valley, New York.
Yeah. And you're holding the trophy. What's it like to hold a championship trophy?
It's just everything. It still ain't even really hit me that we stay champs yet. Because once it hits me, it's going to really hit me that it's over with them. Like they said, we brothers. We love each other. Like, ain't nobody else I would rather go through this with than these 15
this
guys.
This is fantastic.
Nate was offered a scholarship to a four-year school, Western Colorado State. From his mom's vantage point, 3,000 miles away, it seemed like things were falling into place.
They had set him up, you know, an apartment and childcare for the kids and a job for Amber. I mean, everything was just perfect. It just was perfect. So that's why it became even more of a shock.
On the night of April 17th, 2017, Nate called his mom. He was upset. He and Amber had gotten into a fight. Nate and Cassandra talked for a while. Nate told her that he was going to a teammate's house for the night. Cassandra told him that she was going to sleep, that she'd talk to him in the morning.
And the phone rang at 4:36 our time, and it was the sheriff. And they said they needed to, you know, inform me that they found my son. And I'm like, found my son? You found him where? And I said, apparent suicide. I just said, no. All I could do is just scream. It just was shock. You don't imagine that that's a phone call you're going to get. Most people get phone calls that somebody's murdered their child. You don't get a phone call that your child commits suicide. It's not a phone call in our community that you're used to getting, because it's just something that we don't talk about or we don't acknowledge. Or you don't even identify that your child is depressed or could be leading toward that type of action.
It wasn't until after her son was gone that Cassandra realized how much he had been struggling every day. Looking back now, Cassandra believes it was all connected, her son's kindness and his depression.
Part of him calling out for help was helping others, not knowing how to get help for himself.
A little less than a year ago, NBA All-Star DeMar DeRozan tweeted about his own struggle with depression. It led to a wider conversation about athletes and mental health and how the culture of sports makes it difficult for athletes to admit when they need help. But that conversation came too late for Nate Edwards. After she got the call from the sheriff, Cassandra looked at her phone and discovered one last message from her son.
And in his last text, he said to me, he said, "Mommy, even if they put me on medication," he said, "the medication is going to just make me act different." And he says, "I don't want people to see me different." And if I could have had the conversation with him, I could have said to him, "But we could work that out." You know, the medication doesn't have to define you. You define who you are, just as long as we get you help. But I didn't have the opportunity to say that to him.
Cassandra Edwards wasn't the only one left with things unsaid. David Pradell felt that way, too.
He made me believe in myself at a time where I didn't believe in myself. I never told Nate how I appreciated it all and never really said thank you to him. I started to think, what can I do to save his memory? And then I thought about making a documentary about the whole season and about the team and about Nate.
David figured he could use the documentary to raise money, a college fund, for Nate's two sons. It was hard, interviewing Nate's teammates about their loss, worrying about whether he could really do anything to help Nate's family. A year went by. Some of those old irrational thoughts and insecurities came back. But this time, David decided not to keep those thoughts to himself. He shared them with Nate's coach. And with the coach's encouragement, David started seeing a mental health professional. In the fall of 2018, David finally released his documentary. In it, Nate's teammate Alex Wilborn describes what it was like to get the news that Nate was gone.
It just hurt because he was always like the person to me that was so positive. Whenever I had a problem, he helped me through it.
David says he had also planned to interview Nate's girlfriend, Amber, and reach out to his mom, Cassandra. But when it came time, David just couldn't bring himself to do it. When Cassandra learned that a student filmmaker she'd never heard of had released a documentary about her son, she was worried. But it didn't take long for her to understand David's motivations.
David said, "This is the least I could do to say thank you to him."
David Pradell is still seeing a therapist. And when Cassandra Edwards came out to California to see her grandsons over the holidays, she and David spent a couple days together.
You know, David said something really sweet to me. He said he used to draw his energy and he used to get support and encouragement from Nate. But now he says he feels like he's getting it from you.
Yeah, you know what? I think as much as something is taken away, God always tends to fill the void. And I think to a large degree, as much as my son is gone in body, little Nate is also saying, "Mommy, you have a responsibility to David." And I don't ever want to be in a position to know that somebody's hurting and I didn't have an opportunity to encourage them. Or to say, you know what, it's okay not to be okay. See, I couldn't say that to my son. So that's my relationship with David at this point, is making sure that he always feels confident to know that it's okay not to be okay. I do encourage those that need to get professional help to get professional help. because that's what we have professionals, right? But I also say sometimes it just takes smiling at someone or giving them a hug or being an ear to listen. There's so many other aspects of humanity that can bring life into people.
We'll have links to David Prudell's documentary and the GoFundMe page for Nate Edwards' sons at onlyagame.org. If you or somebody you know might need help, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 at 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. Blessing Okagbare missed the 2008 Olympic long jump final by 1 centimeter. She thought her Olympics were over, but then...
She tells me at lunch that she had a dream that they called her back to go to the final.
That's coming up on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Amazon, Google, Facebook. Big companies are getting really big. Is that a problem? Listen to Planet Money's new series on big business, competition, and antitrust law in America. That's on Planet Money.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, NPR's Peter Sagal talks about running, male body image, and Spider-Man costumes. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's sports news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
Let's start with Manny Machado, who has signed a $300 million 10-year contract with the San Diego Padres. It's the largest free agent deal in history. Is he worth it?
He's worth it if he can get it. That's the way I've always felt about baseball salaries. Yeah, this is a heck of a deal. My spidey sense is tingling, of course, because there's all this kind of talk of collusion, then all of a sudden,
right,
like nine teams show up to bid on Manny Machado as though nobody is pulling the strings.
Well, as you mentioned, as soon as the news of the deal broke, pundits started weighing in on what this means in the larger baseball free agency is broken narrative. I mean, on the one hand, the largest free agent deal in history means the system can't be completely rigged against the players, right?
Well, it can be shown to be not completely rigged. Let's put it that way.
Right.
I mean, it's a rigged marketplace if for 6 months you don't get any offers anywhere, and then in one day you get 8 or 9. Somebody is manipulating the market. That doesn't just happen.
Players union head Tony Clark is using words like collusion and possible strike. Do you think that there is another baseball strike on the horizon?
Well, there's always a baseball strike on the horizon. That's been a permanent fact of life following baseball for about 40 years now. Somewhere in our future, there's another whopping big collusion settlement on the horizon for sure.
Former L.A. Dodger pitcher Don Newcomb died on Tuesday. He was 92. He's remembered for being one of the first African-American pitchers in Major League Baseball and for being one of the first African-American All-Stars. How will you remember him?
Well, for his achievements on the field, but also because he was one of the very first high-profile athletes to come out publicly and admit his alcoholism, mm-hmm, and to crusade for what would eventually be called substance abuse programs long before anyone else did. And I think that's a great service he did to the game.
Well, our listeners might remember that Newcomb also fought for the rights of athletes to control their own image. And this was after Coors used his image in a beer commercial, which you point out would be highly inappropriate.
Yeah, I thought somebody at Coors should have gotten fired behind that because it was remarkably stupid.
Let's talk about the dumpster fire in New Orleans, Charlie. That's how Pelicans head coach Alvin Gentry is describing it anyway. The Pelicans fired GM Del Demps just a week ago because I guess it's easier to fire a GM than it is to get rid of an unhappy superstar, right?
Well, the whole Anthony Davis thing has torn the franchise apart, which is unfortunate. But Anthony Davis wants to play where Anthony Davis wants to play, and he has the hammer now. And I don't think it has served the fans of New Orleans for the franchise to have torn itself up and ripped its own guts out over this problem. They had to have seen this coming.
Before the Pelicans and Demps parted ways, the NBA made clear that the team would be fined if they tried to sit Anthony Davis for the rest of the season. They would do that to protect his trade value. Now the Pelicans and interim GM Danny Ferry are hoping to change the NBA's mind. Do you think they have a chance?
I don't know. I'm not, you know, legal beagle enough, even though I do occasionally play one on this show. It is a form of open consumer fraud if Anthony Davis is healthy, not to play him. So I can see the league's point. At the same time, all of this is an unnecessary disaster. At bottom, this is a fairly ordinary free agent situation that's been blown into a fiasco by incompetence on the part of management in New Orleans.
Charlie, are you ready for Olympic breakdancing?
You know what? I've spouted off about sports that are judged and how much I hate them, and I really wish that every sport had a scoreboard. If you're going to do rhythmic gymnastics, you can do breakdance. If you're going to, you know, seriously, if you're going to do synchronized swimming, let alone synchronized diving, you can do breakdancing. Yeah, sure, why not?
Well, I love how they're adding this to the Olympic program as a new sport meant to attract the youngins to the Olympic movement. But breakdancing was huge when I was in elementary school.
Yeah,
I'm kind of old.
I was going to say, is this the final proof that breakdancing's not cool anymore? It's going to be in the Olympics?
And finally, Charlie,
I
know that you are a fan of fencing, so I'm going to let you explain the newest discipline officially recognized by the French Fencing Federation.
As much as I love fencing, as much as I love to compete in it, as much as I love to talk about it, as much as I love to watch it, the people who run it are like the stodgiest people on the planet. I mean, they make the International Olympic Committee look like Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five.
We should explain that this is lightsaber fencing.
It's lightsaber fencing. Now, you can't cut anybody in half. I mean, you can't. I mean, it's like the people who play Quidditch by running around the ground on brooms. But it's got the sound effects. It's played in complete darkness, so you see the lights going on. And I say, bonne chance.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce from time to time at Sports Illustrated, and he joins us each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
Most Olympians never even get one chance to win an Olympic medal. But in 2008, one Olympian got two. Reporter Jim Foley has the story.
Blessing Okegbare is from Sapele, a small port city in Nigeria.
We didn't really have a stadium back home. We have some grasses in school when we just actually train.
Sapele is more known for its hot weather than for being a hotbed for track and field. So when Blessing wanted to compete for a college in the U.S., she had one stipulation.
She was never fond of cold weather, so we were fortunate to be located where we were. And I think that's pretty much how she made her decision ultimately.
That's former University of Texas El Paso assistant coach Calvin Robinson. He recruited Blessing from 7,000 miles away.
I was so happy because I thought about it like this is something that I think I need. It's really going to be good for my career.
Blessing was a superstar at UTEP, where she won four national championships in track and field. Her specialty became the long jump. During summer break, Blessing went back to her home country of Nigeria to try to qualify for the Beijing 2008 Summer Olympics.
And I jump a personal best, 686.
6.86 meters. That's 22 and a half feet. And it was her ticket to Beijing.
We were all kind of just on a high excitement level, to be honest with you, of just the overall atmosphere. I mean, it's the Olympics, for God's sake. So who wouldn't be excited?
I felt the same. I was a college student from Boston and an intern for the Olympic News Service. My job was to conduct interviews for track and field events at Beijing's National Stadium. I was nervous and I wasn't even competing. August 18th, 2008 was the day of the Olympic women's long jump qualifying round. Blessing says she was overwhelmed walking into the 91,000-seat track and field stadium known as the Bird's Nest.
Instead of like me focusing on jumping, this girl was busy looking at people compete, watching the crowd, watching the seats, the stadium, how they cheer. And I kind of lost focus.
Everything was new to her at that time. So I can sense the nerves that she had going into the qualifying round. And that it concerned me, to be quite honest.
The top 12 out of 44 jumpers would advance to the final round. Blessing jumped 6.59 meters.
I finished 13th overall. I didn't make the final.
Blessing had fallen just 1/100th of a meter short of the opportunity of a lifetime. Just one spot short of the chance to jump in the final and earn an Olympic medal for her country.
I was crying. I was staring at my coach. Felt so bad for me.
Robinson tried to console her.
We kind of just went over and reiterated, you know, how successful a year she had had.
Me, I was just ready to go home because I feel like I was just useless in Beijing already. I was just still depressed.
You know, I was looking for the first plane home, to be quite honest.
So he called the airline and they said they don't have no space for the ticket, for the flight. Like, he can't change it, nothing. Went to the airport, nothing.
Blessing and her coach were stuck in Beijing. But the day before the final, something strange happened.
She tells me at lunch that she had a dream that they called her back to go to the final.
He laughed so hard. That man laughed at me.
Lo and behold, I think we got the call later that evening that she was had actually gotten placed back into the final.
And I said, I didn't make the final, sir. He said, no, you just made the final. I was like, what? I screamed so loud.
One of the long jump finalists, Ukrainian Lyudmila Blonska, had been disqualified for doping.
It was a freebie, man. It was like a get-out-of-jail-free card, to be honest. So at that point, it was, okay, you got this second opportunity. Let's not waste it. We were just playing with house money at that time.
On Friday, August 22nd, 2008, it was time for the Olympic long jump final.
I put a lot of stock in how an athlete moves around, what their demeanor is during warm-ups. And when I tell you she probably had the best warm-up of her life going into the final, I knew something special was going to happen. I didn't know if it would equate into a medal, but I knew she was at least going to be competitive and jump very well.
International sports journalist Jeremy Inson was covering the track and field events with me.
You could tell there was something building. You could see her. She sort of grew into it. Her emotions started coming through.
Blessing was the last jumper in the starting order.
She takes her first jump, and, you know, it's a sound through the stadium that you hear. You could always hear when she had a big jump.
I took every jump like it was my last, and it was worth it.
Blessing recorded a personal best 6.91 meters, good enough for the bronze medal.
And I got that medal against all odds.
Blessing was overcome with happiness as she took the podium to receive the bronze.
Overwhelming delight, disbelief, and just being caught up in the emotion of it and the joy, you know, celebrating with her coach.
That was probably one of the most overlooked stories of those games. You know, it was a big deal.
In the span of 4 days, Blessing went from falling short of her dream to earning a career in track and field.
It was like my breakout moment.
That medal definitely helped catapult her to the international athlete that she is today.
Blessing made the Olympics again in 2012 and 2016, but she did not win a medal. Now 30 years old, she has one more chance at Tokyo 2020, with tempered expectations.
Time hits us all, man. Father Time is undefeated.
Blessing is living in Texas. She's training to be a nurse. And she's really glad she wasn't able to catch a flight home from Beijing that day in 2008.
These chances don't just come. It came for a reason. And if you don't take advantage of it, something wrong with you. Something is definitely wrong with you.
That story came from reporter Jim Foley. Thanks also to UTEP track and field head coach Bob Kitchens for his help on this story. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Nico Emack and Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.